to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas, arts editor of the TLS. And that's it, I'm afraid, because our usual co-host, Alex Clark, has been suddenly struck down with COVID, which is still happening. So she can't join us this week. So it's just me. We've got lots of wonderful things lined up. So do bear with me. I'm not going to chat with myself at the beginning of this because that would be weird. But I'm going to tell you about a letter we got from a listener this week. I don't know if I can use his full name, so I'm just going to say John. We got a letter from John referring to our recent item when we were talking about books made of odd things, among them a mortadella, which I was excited by, and cheese. So John says, your recent item on books made from strange materials, not least cheese, reminded me of a couple of libraries I came across in Tibet. One comprised entirely of volumes made from slate, and another with its tomes made from cloth. He's attached a couple of pictures of those, and they're really beautiful, especially the ones with the books made of cloth. So anything can be a book, I think, is the moral of the story. Now, coming up on this week's show, we look at the friendships of the apparently alpha male Duke of Wellington, whose friends were, perhaps surprisingly, female. But first, we're going to have dinner. It's the late 18th century, our dinner is at 3 o'clock, and the food, I'm afraid, is not great, but the company is. We might be dining with Mary Wollstonecraft, William Blake, Henry Fuseli, Joseph Priestley, and William Wordsworth, for instance, because we are having dinner with Joseph Johnson, the publisher who knew, published, and fed all these people and many more. He's the subject of a new book, a group biography called Dinner with Joseph Johnson, Books and Friendship in a Revolutionary Age by Daisy Hay. Daisy Hay is also writing about Charles Lamb for us in the paper this week, so it all ties up. Dinner with Joseph Johnson has been expertly reviewed for us this week by Catherine Sutherland, and we're delighted that she joins us today to talk it through. Catherine, many thanks for joining us.
Hello, it's a great pleasure. I'm very happy to be here.
We're very happy to have you. Can we start by talking about Joseph Johnson? Who was he, and how did he come to be at the centre of this extraordinary group of writers and thinkers?
Yes. This is an extraordinarily generous and capacious book. It's filled with personalities and stories, and a bit like a multi-plot Dickens novel, the character at its centre is almost the least knowable of any of the characters there, and that's Joseph Johnson. So Daisy Hay has quite a challenge to find Joseph Johnson. A little bit of background, perhaps, first. We're in London. We're in London between 1760 and 1810. These are the years in which Johnson is running his business as a publisher and bookseller. And we're in the old city of London, which had been at the heart of the book trade since medieval times, centred around St. Paul's and St. Paul's Churchyard. And this time, 1760 to 1810, it's a time of social, political and cultural change across Britain and abroad. There's discontent in the American colonies, there's revolution brewing across the Channel in France. And it's also a time of huge change in the printing industry, an unprecedented expansion of those able to read, and a corresponding explosion in all kinds of reading matter, not just books, but periodicals, pamphlets, newspapers. It's a world in which to write and to read is to take up an ideological position. And the close of the century saw war and threats of war with America, with France. It saw civil unrest and it saw press censorship, which reinforced emerging divisions in reading and its target audiences. So society and its modes of communication, as it were, even the limits of what could be imagined, were being reset by print. So what's going on is a revolution in public consciousness. And Joseph Johnson is right at the heart of this, bookseller and publisher for 50 years, roughly 1760 to 1809. And his business is a magnet, as you've suggested already, Lucy, for a remarkable group of writers, mainly, though not all, of liberal and progressive views. They're dedicated to making change happen and to making what they believe will be a better world through ideas and through print. So they're writing not just on politics, but on medicine, mathematics, science, education, women's rights. And Johnson is the man who makes a space for their books and their conversation. But in fact, we know very little about Johnson himself. He's left very little personal trace beyond the minimal title page imprint. And on his books, you have this regular imprint, J. Johnson, number 72, St. Paul's Churchyard. And that's, of course, the focus of Daisy Hay's book, What is Going On at Number 72, St. Paul's Churchyard. There's been a previous biography of Johnson back in 1979 by Gerald Tyson, and more recently in 2003, Helen Braithwaite has looked at Romanticism, Publishing and Dissent and the world around Johnson. And very recently, too, John Bugg has published what appeared just really from nowhere in 1994, which was a crucial piece of evidence about Joseph Johnson. And that was the Joseph Johnson Letter Book, a selection of letters that Johnson made copies of his outgoing correspondence. We know that Johnson, in fact, destroyed most of his business records, but we have these 200 letters that came to light in 1994 and Bugg published in 2016, giving us some idea of Johnson's dealings in really the last 10 years of his business.
Can I ask about the part of his background? He came from, or he became, I'm not sure, a dissenter, didn't he? And that was very important. Did that mean that if you were a dissenter, you were by definition a bit of a radical, just for being?
You were a bit of an outsider. It certainly meant you were a liberal and progressive, yes, a radical. Right. So we know he was born in November 1738 in Everton near Liverpool. And he was the second son of a Baptist landowner and businessman. And by 1753, he turns up in London, where he's apprenticed to a man called George Keith, who is a Baptist publisher. So he's moving from birth in Baptist circles, and Baptists were part of the dissenting community.
Yeah, okay.
It was a broad community. Basically, everyone who wasn't Church of England and didn't follow Church of England orthodoxy. And it did mean that you were an outsider in various ways. For instance, the grammar schools, the traditional grammar schools were closed to you. Also certain professions, and you didn't have access to Oxford and Cambridge.
You were marginalised. I mean, there were real effects.
Sure. You were marginalised. Career opportunities were limited. At the same time, though, this dissenting community has deep roots and it's been going on for a long, long time, you know, since the 16th century almost. And it's got its own intellectual momentum and it had its own dissenting academies. And from very early on, Joseph Johnson is publishing the writings of those who were nurtured in or taught in the dissenting academies. And one of the first, of course, that he works with is very close to Liverpool, where Joseph Priestley was a teacher and where John Aikin was a pupil, and John Aikin's sister, Anna Aikin, later Barbauld, was also a vigorous intellectual presence. But we know that right from the start, you know, he's an seven-year apprentice to a Baptist publisher of religious tracts. And that immediately, I think, gives us a sense that, you know, for the Baptists, books were not just articles of commerce, sure they were that, but they were also articles of faith. And the printing press was a means of disseminating knowledge widely. So they had a very democratic view of the importance of learning and of its spread. We know that by the age of 22 in 1761, he set up his own shop and very quickly he has a bestseller in 1764, and that's John Newton's book, An Authentic Narrative, which was a bit like a Robinson Crusoe story in a way. I mean, John Newton was a former slave trader turned Church of England minister. We perhaps know him best now for the fact that he introduced William Cowper, the poet, to Joseph Johnson, and Johnson became Cowper's um, Cooper's publisher too, but this book by Newton was a runaway success in 1764, and basically it was a combination of conversion narrative and romance and politics and tales of maritime adventure when, you know, covering the time when Newton was in fact a slave trader.
Does Newton repent of being a slave trader?
He does repent. Well, he converts to and he becomes an Anglican minister and repents in that sense. But the book is extraordinary in the way it also uses those adventures very openly and to create excitement in the reader.
Clearly, from an early age, Johnson, he's a great facilitator. So hence the 3 o'clock dinners. Was that a thing that he kind of formally set up?
I mean, he is just a great enabler. He is one of the great enablers of this extraordinary world of print, which is the Romantic era. And so he's sitting at the heart of this world. We know that, he doesn't move into 72 St. Paul's until 1770, because his previous premises were destroyed, completely destroyed by fire. So he's in 72 St. Paul's churchyard by 1770, and he seems very quickly to have established the place as a meeting point. And of course, booksellers, shops, publishers' shops were meeting points regularly at that time. But what distinguishes him is perhaps two things. One, that some of his writers seem regularly to have stayed with him. So when Mary Wollstonecraft fetches up in London in 1787, she just comes to his door, bangs on the door, he takes her in, and she stays there for a few weeks till she finds lodgings. Joseph Priestley, from the Warrington Academy, stayed there quite regularly. And Henry Fuseli was a long-term inmate of 72 St. Paul's Churchyard. So he ran the place. I suppose an equivalent might be, you know, a little like Shakespeare and Company in 1920s Paris. He gave refuge and both financial and material support of all kinds to writers. Mm. In the place.
Is that part of what the dinners were, actually, just feeding people?
They were just feeding people, for sure, yeah. But also they were just a regular weekly meeting, the 3 o'clock dinner. Every week he would offer these dinners to whatever writers were passing through and in town.
So just to absolutely drag things down to the very material level, what did they eat at the 3 o'clock dinners?
Well, apparently it was an unvarying menu, and it sounds like our sort of worst nightmares of school dinners, actually. It was boiled fish, it was roast veal, that sounds quite nice, but boiled vegetables and rice pudding.
It doesn't sound great, does it?
No, a constant dinner. The constant dinner was, you know, extremely nourishing, no doubt, but I imagine that many of the guests were there for the conversation.
It was very important, wasn't it? The idea, it's not just about kind of chit-chat, how are you? The idea of the exchange of ideas and views, differing ideas and views, and that you kind of argue your case, that was extremely important at the time, wasn't it?
Extremely important at the time, and deep roots in dissenting theology too. And the dissenters did dissent, they debated, and there was a strong conviction amongst the different groups of dissenters, of all these non-orthodox groups, that you had to find your own way to understanding. So independent thought, but independent thought through debate and conversation with others. So through association, through listening and learning, keeping an open mind, being liberal.
So we can see that background was very important, I mean, crucial, yeah, really, to the setting up of it. And how important was the revolutionary aspect? Because the book's subtitle says a revolutionary age. And it, as you say, it was revolutionary in all sorts of ways. I mean, in very literal ways, yeah, in France, but also, as you say, intellectually.
And technologically, you know, with the innovations in book production and with new formats coming out as well, more newspapers, more periodicals. We know that, you know, Johnson himself established his own periodical, the Analytical Review, in 1788 as a kind of monthly debating forum and a mix of reviews, essays, new books, articles of on medicine, music, natural sciences, as well as poetry and reviews of novels and so on. It was a huge mix. Yes, many of the analytical review itself, which was, you know, the periodical from his shop, it was generally critical of the reactionary British government and generally supportive of revolutionary ideas in America and France, as were Johnson's authors, the writers on his list.
It's very interesting, I think, and enlivening the fact that, as you say, it's not just, they're not just talking about literature or poetry. It's really, and the advances are also being made in medicine and science and all these areas, and they're just as live, aren't they? Just they're treated around the same table.
Yeah, that's right. They are. So, you know, at any one dinner, you might have Henry Fuseli there, you know, who the Johnson's lifelong friend, who's Swiss emigre, who was an illustrator, he was a writer, he was a painter. But you would also have Joseph Priestley, who was an extraordinary polymath and a scientist. Mm. He was, in fact, nominated as official scientist on Captain Cook's second expedition. But because of his beliefs, the nomination was overturned by the authorities. So you'd have him there. You might have his pupil, John Aikin, who was a medic who had trained in the Warrington Academy and then went on to Edinburgh University, who wrote what seems to us a remarkably commonsensical book on how to treat patients in hospital, but was actually really quite revolutionary at the time, you know, suggesting that you might open the windows and air the beds and get them to the patients to walk around a little bit.
As you say, it seems like common sense, but actually that didn't happen for quite a while, did it?
No, I mean, Florence Nightingale saying the same thing a century later, isn't she? And so you have educationalists, you have writers for children as well. This was a burgeoning area in the 18th century, and Johnson was one of the leading publishers in the field of children's writing. So yes, a huge mix. So you at any one dinner, you might have had, you know, a couple of political thinkers, a philosopher, a mathematician, and a poet. Mm. All sort of debating together and finding common ground.
And as you say, he was, I mean, you were talking about particularly Mary Wollstonecraft, but a great champion of women writers. And also, as we touched on, interested in the abolitionist movement.
Yes, he was a supporter of the abolitionists, as were so many of his writers, of course. And you think not just of Newton, but of William Cowper. Throughout his career, his list features women writers, and I think that's really one of the most interesting aspects of him for us. 1774, so that's quite early on, he publishes Mary Scott's The Female Advocate. And in the 1770s and 80s and 90s, he's publishing Sarah Trimmer, who actually is a high Anglican. But he's publishing her writings, her books for children, and he's publishing Wollstonecraft and Barbauld. And then in the 1800s, when Wollstonecraft is dead, he's publishing Charlotte Smith, who was one of the most popular writers of the time, and Maria Edgeworth. And throughout, he's reprinting Barbauld's books, you know, her most popular works, things like Lessons for Children, went through multiple editions, were a kind of, you know, nursery staple right through into the 1810s. And so even when she's not producing new books, she's still part of his list.
Does the group biography approach work? Does it? I mean, you say it's difficult to shed light on him, but does it shed light on Joseph Johnson himself?
I think it's quite interesting because in the end, it's a biography of personalities and of strong personalities who are circling round a man whose personality is hard to find. So that's one thing. And the other thing, of course, is that in a sense, it's a bibliobiography because it's a biography of books. I found this quite exciting, really. When I was reading the book and when I was trying to write the review, a phrase that was buzzing in my head was something that I just read, actually. It was apparently something that Elena Ferranti said, that enigmatic Italian novelist in the New York Times. And she's credited there with saying, "I believe that books, once they are written, have no need of authors." And as readers, we can take that kind of statement two ways, can't we? We can focus on the book itself and what we learn from it. You know, by contrast, it can stimulate us even more wanting to know about this unknowable person. And here we have Johnson, the unknowable publisher. The authors and the books he brought into the light are his legacy. But then his unknowability has a kind of power and charm. And you keep being drawn back into this kind of question mark all the time as you're reading this book. And I've found that, in a way, one of the most generous aspects of the book. I mean, it's generous in that it has a huge cast of personalities, but also it's generous in that it doesn't try to close things down or attach labels. You know, what we know about Johnson is fairly minimal, and it's also minimal in some other intriguing areas. And Hay draws our attention to these other gaps. For instance, what really was Johnson's relationship to Fuseli? Now, Fuseli arrives very early in Johnson's life, and he's there to the end. What was his relationship to Mary Wollstonecraft? Previous biographers have tried to suggest what these relationships might have been. And one of the things I like about Hay's book is the fact that she doesn't try to close things down. She allows imagination to swirl around these possible relationships. I mean, Godwin apparently thought and said in his memoir of Wollstonecraft that was published in 1798 by Johnson, Godwin actually says there that Johnson was almost a father to Wollstonecraft.
Right.
Hay refuses that. She refuses to close it down. She argues instead that, you know, Johnson, as an outsider himself, understood the importance to Mary Wollstonecraft of making her own way in the world, in a world that was a man's world, that, you know, she too was an outsider in a certain kind of world. And Hay refuses to pin things down. And instead, what you have is a biography that's a kind of a conversation, an ongoing conversation with different points of view being put forward at different moments. One of the nice things about it is the dining room, and you return to it every 10 years. And she has this small vignette where she describes the dining room 10 years on and who might have been in it. And in between these vignettes, then you have, you know, what really is a fairly straightforward bibliobiography of what Johnson is publishing in that period. But I found those vignettes, they really are, they do catch the imagination, the idea that you have many voices and you see Johnson, as it were, through a prism.
And in a way that he was kind of an outsider who's got himself at the centre of actually an enormous amount of things.
And yeah, I think that's a really good way of describing it. And how do you describe an outsider at the centre? You know, where exactly is he? Is he outside or is he inside?
There are lots of other kind of literary, you know, catalysts and facilitators and things, but there's often quite a lot of ego involved.
That's right.
We often know quite a bit about them because they want to be known themselves as well. But there really doesn't seem to be here.
You don't have that sense at all. You don't have that sense at all. You have the sense of a rather humble man. In fact, one of the things that when I, you know, was reading the book, I started doing my own little bit of research around him. And one of the things that I found most interesting and most moving was John Aitken, the pupil from the Warrington Academy, the pupil of Priestley, who then published with Johnson, who wrote a short obituary of Johnson for the December 1809 issue of the Gentleman's Magazine. Johnson dies in 1809. And it's very short, but he describes there a man whose house and purse were always open to the calls of friendship, kindred or misfortune. A man who was neither sanguine nor pushing, in either in his temperament nor in his attitude to authors. And already you have, you know, by somebody who knew him very well, you have this sense of a person who was receding into the shade, a man who didn't push himself forward. The other thing that Akin mentions, and I think it is worth saying something about, is that Johnson was a great innovator, really, in book design. He says one of the things that Johnson wanted to do, this was an age where book prices were incredibly fluctuating and new works could be particularly expensive and outside the reach of most people. And Akin says, you know, Johnson did his best to drive down costs. And sometimes his authors didn't like the result, he says, but he made sure that the book circulated widely. So he was interested in reaching as wide a readership as possible. One of his great innovations, of course, was in printing children's books. And he and Anna Barbauld worked together to produce a page design that would actually be appealing to a child. Books before Johnson didn't really do that, but instead he gives, you know, he leaves lots of white space and he has large type and it's an unfussy page. It's a page that invites a child in. So I think Johnson as an innovator in book design is also worth thinking about too.
Well, it sounds like we have him to thank for many, many things. That this rather enigmatic figure,
that's right,
at the centre of this wonderful circle. But Catherine Sutherland, many thanks for talking to us about him today.
It's a pleasure, thank you.
Still to come on the show, did you know that the conqueror of Napoleon at Waterloo, the Iron Duke of Wellington, was widely known and often mocked as a man who preferred the company of women? Nor did we. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas. Now, we're still talking about friendships, but of a different kind, in different circles, and in the next generation or so along. There is a new exhibition at Apsley House in London, known as the Duke of Wellington's Mansion, which still has quarters for the current Duke of Wellington, I believe. And the title of this exhibition is Wellington, Women and Friendship. Now, as our reviewer Boyd Tonkin points out, there has been plenty of gossip and rumour about Wellington and women over the past two centuries, but very little mention of friendship. We're delighted that Boyd can join us today to tell us about a lesser known side of the so-called Iron Duke. Boyd, thanks very much for coming on.
Not at all. I'm very, very pleased to be here.
As you say, the Duke of Wellington, Arthur Wellesley, he was dogged by rumours of affairs throughout his life, wasn't he? But can you tell us about this other side that the exhibition wants to highlight, about his friendships with women?
Bear in mind that Wellington was born in 1769. He lived until 1852. So he started as a Georgian. He finished as a Victorian. And his outlook was, I think, very much determined by his early life. As a professional soldier, of the Georgian and Regency period, in many cases, gossip would not have bothered him too much. After all, this was what swaggering warriors were supposed to do. And a trail of rumours was not necessarily any kind of deficit or drawback to the ambitious soldier. What's really unusual about Wellington is how many of these associations, whether they were affairs or not, develop into proper friendships. And that is untypical for a man of his status at his time.
So how does the exhibition go about showing that these are friendships?
Well, it's quite a small exhibition, but it's very, very revealing. Basically, there are two rooms. One in the basement galleries is taken up with documents, in other words, with the journals of his women confidants, with letters to and from Wellington, and some other contemporary material such as caricatures. And of course, Wellington was endlessly caricatured and often in an extremely ribald and mocking light. And then upstairs, which is perhaps the heart of the exhibition, is a room full of portraits of the women of Wellington's extended family and of these friends, these confidants with whom he kept up such a close relationship, in many cases over decades. And these have largely been borrowed. So in other words, it's the women who would have known Apsley House being reunited there for probably the first time since Wellington lived in the house.
You talk about the reputation. Well, there's two sides of it, as you say. There's the kind of, oh, he's had lots of affairs, and that wouldn't necessarily be particularly noteworthy, nor would it necessarily bother him, as you say. But then the other side of it was that at the time, it was known, wasn't it, and sort of rather disparagingly talked about the fact that he was friends with women. You mentioned that Robert Peel said, "No man has any influence with him. He is led by women."
Oh, yes. Well, this is what is perhaps most unusual about these friendships, in that they were not simply, as it were, relaxation after the heat of battle and later the heat of politics. He was using his women friends as political interlocutors. They were talking to him about affairs of state. He was taking their advice, not only on domestic, but on public matters as well. Now, it's important to bear in mind that these women were not, in general, part of what we would think as the advance guard of emancipated female thinkers of the time. They were part of his circle, which was Tory and aristocratic and quite conventional. But nevertheless, they were people who had a very, very lively interest and knowledge of politics. And he would consult them, and he would often be guided by them, although not always. I mean, there is one exhibit in the exhibition is of his response to perhaps the most, his favourite confidant, Harriet Arbuthnot. And Harriet, although she was a Tory, was in favour of the Great Reform Act of 1832. And of course, Wellington, the diehard reactionary, was initially against it, although he later modified his opinion. And he writes to her saying, "If you don't mind, on this occasion, I won't take your advice, but I'll stick with my own opinion." But the very fact that he writes it shows that there were occasions on which he did take her advice.
Yes, and that sounds like a proper back and forth. He's listened properly to what she said and taken it seriously, but said, actually, on reflection. I was going to ask you about the kind of reactionary side, because difficult for us to think about him now, about what a huge kind of hero he was. And then, as you say, he was sort of considered as a very, very conservative, wasn't he? Small and big C, rather reactionary. Do you think this shows another side? Because it was unusual, especially in a soldier, and then I guess a politician, to take women sort of seriously and have proper friendships, wasn't it?
It was, and this is what makes him such an interesting figure. He is divided between this public persona, which becomes increasingly obdurate and conservative and opposed to all the reforms and changes of the age, maybe with one exception, which he helped to get the Catholic Emancipation Bill through. And this perhaps is related to his Irish background. But in private, he has this much greater sense of emotional flexibility. He listens, he's close to women, he treats them as equals in the realm of friendship that they create. And you realize that he lives in the same emotional world as the poets he so despised, the Byrons, the Shelleys, and so forth, the people he thought were really beneath contempt. And there's a very interesting link between Wellington and Lord Byron, whom you can otherwise think of as his absolute antithesis. And it's that Lady Caroline Lamb was very keen on both of them at different kinds.
Excellent. It's a good link. I wonder though, I mean, did Byron have proper female friendships? It sounds as though actually Wellington might have taken women more seriously than Byron did.
That's an excellent point, and I think you're right. I think in terms of long-haul sharing of emotions, sharing of ideas, meeting of minds, I think Wellington is the more genuine romantic rather than Byron.
Well, that's not something you hear every day, is it?
No.
And you say that the exhibition wisely avoids the kind of gossipy did they didn't they kind of narrative when it's talking about the individual women that he was particular friends with.
But largely because it is completely irresolvable. I mean, contemporaries assumed that he was jumping into bed with all of these women, clearly, at the time, especially in the 1820s and 1830s, you have a very, very scurrilous popular media through broadsheets, through caricatures, and so on. And it's very keen to mock the randy old Duke of Wellington. So there's a caricature of him sort of sitting astride the huge barrel of a cannon, and there's a lady nearby saying, "Oh, bless me, what a spanker!" And it really, that there's this kind of carry on Duke element,
seaside postcard kind of thing.
Completely, yes. But also, I think it would be equally mistaken to say, "Oh, they were all perfectly proper." Platonic friendships with respectable married ladies. I think the truth is probably in some cases there was a sexual element, in other cases there was not. The interesting thing about Wellington is that whether it existed or not does not seem to have affected the way he treated his women friends, which again is something that actually sounds quite modern, as opposed to the very strict divisions of early 19th century sexual attitudes where women very much would have been divided into the respectable and unrespectable and treated as such.
And there's one particular woman that we haven't mentioned yet, which is his wife. You say she's a kind of, she's a rather sad figure in the middle of this, but this casts a bit of light on her, is that right?
Well, this is one of the really illuminated aspects of the exhibition, that she is so much in the shadows. It's a terrible marriage from the outset. For a start, it's delayed for about 10 years. And when they finally marry in 1806, Wellington knows that from the off that he's made a mistake. And he neglects her. He's very sharp and short with her. He realizes that she is never going to be the kind of conversational partner that he needs in his military and political career. And for her part, Kitty Packenham, she's stuck at home. She's depressed, she's lonely, she's idle, and her letters really make very, very sad reading. So we shouldn't forget that all of these really quite sparkling and profound friendships are built on the very, very sad bedrock of a completely failed marriage.
He didn't find that companionship with Herb, and I suppose he was able to find it with other people, but she wasn't, I guess, because her circle would be so much more circumscribed than his.
Well, yes. I mean, he says in a letter to Harriet Arbuthnot that I was never in love with her. I married her because they told me to, and I didn't know myself, which is the most appalling and devastating revelation. But it also, I think, shows the degree of self-knowledge that he brought to these friendships.
Yes, and he can't have been, as you say, if it was put off for 10 years, he wasn't just a young man who didn't know anything. He can't have been, can he? If it was it was kind of social convention that pushed him into it, wasn't it?
It was social convention. It was the desire for respectability. It was the very fragile nature of his family background. Now, if you say that Wellington was an Anglo-Irish aristocrat, that's perfectly true, but it doesn't capture the sheer insecurity of many of his class. Their prospects in the world were not guaranteed. He wasn't an oldest son. He was a middle son. His father was a rather interesting and eccentric character who was basically a musician. He became professor of music at Trinity College, Dublin.
So actually not that respectable being a musician in those days, really.
Not at all, especially if you have a title and you were expected just to
do a proper job.
to swan around being a nobleman.
Yes.
So all of this connects with Wellington's pursuit of solidity and respectability, which, of course, he managed to find through his military career and to some extent through his marriage. But nothing about his progress was given. Nothing was guaranteed.
Right. It's funny because seeing him from this side of things, you just think he's a kind of, you know, as I say, the kind of immutable heroic. And then he seems completely solid and I don't know what the word is, inevitable, but that's not the case at all then.
No, I think, of course, the really interesting comparison, Wellington, born in Ireland in 1769 to this rather insecure family with aristocratic ancestry. There's someone else born on an island in 1769.
I think I know where you're heading.
To an insecure family with some aristocratic connections. And that, of course, is Signor Bonaparte, who became his nemesis, his other, his counterpart in every possible way.
Yes. And that was part of, I read something that they called him, I can't remember who it was, calls him the world victor's victor. He just, because everybody was so terrified of Napoleon at one point, and the fact that Wellington was very much involved in his downfall meant that he did have an unshakable position, didn't he?
Well, he had an unshakable position, not only in Britain, but across the whole of Europe. I mean, if you look at his political interests and what he's talking about with these women, especially in the years after Waterloo, their coverage, their span of attention really encompasses the whole of Europe. He really was the opposite of a little England. He had this notion of the concert of Europe, of what was necessary to establish and secure peace from Russia to Portugal, in his mind constantly.
Mm. And of these women who we talked to, you've mentioned a couple. Were there particular ones? Was there a sort of small handful that stayed with him for a long time?
I think so. Perhaps Harriet Arbuthnot is the most important in terms of the sheer depth and consistency of their communication. But there are also very many other important figures, such as his American friend, Marianne Patterson, who he clearly loved quite deeply and commissioned a portrait both of himself and of her from Thomas Lawrence. And weirdly, Marianne ends up marrying his widowed elder brother, Richard. So she concludes as his sister-in-law, which is a rather kind of strange outcome to this relationship.
Yeah.
Then there's, for instance, Princess Lieven, who was the wife of the Russian ambassador and very much a diplomatic player in her own right, and someone else who had this panoramic grasp of European politics and knowledge of how to intervene. And then late in his life, there's the very, very interesting figure of Angela Burdett Coutts. He became known a bit later as one of the greatest of Victorian philanthropists. And in the 1830s, when she's in her 30s and he is in his, I think, late 70s, she ends up proposing to him, and he, in a rather gentle, grandfatherly way, discreetly just pushes her own way and says, "Don't be silly. I'm old enough to be your grandfather." But I think the relationship with Angela Burdett Coutts indicates that he was able to inspire a very, very high degree of loyalty and affection from women really well into old age.
Mm-hmm.
And there must have been something behind that. He couldn't just have been the rather gruff, monosyllabic, terse, soldierly figure who appears in some memoirs of the period.
No, because and all the letters and the correspondence.
Yes,
shows that can't have been the case. So, after seeing this exhibition, has it changed your view of him a bit? Do you think differently about him now?
Well, I did know the background to some of this material, but on the other hand, I think it widens the picture for anyone, even if you think you know a little about Wellington. And certainly if all you know about Wellington is the kind of stalwart military victor, the vanquisher of Napoleon, the reactionary prime minister of the 1820s and 1830s, it will, I think, make a huge difference to the way that you view him.
It's such a lovely idea that deep down he was a romantic. Even a romantic with a small R or a capital R.
Well, I think he detested the romantics with a big R, but as you say, privately, maybe there was quite a lot of small R romantic there.
Well, it's good to think about him that way. Boyd Tonkin, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Lucy.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Catherine Sutherland and Boyd Tonkin. And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast produced by Sophia Franklin. We'll be back next week, but for now, goodbye.